Lila Hoth smiled again, but then the smile faded. The bad news started. The stable situation lasted a year, and then it ended. The Soviet infantry's inevitable military reward for good performance was to be handed ever more dangerous tasks. The same the world over, the same throughout history. You don't get a pat on the back and a ride home. You get a map instead. Svetlana's company was one of many ordered to push north and east up the Korengal Valley. The valley was 6 miles long. It was the only navigable route out of Pakistan. The Hindu Kush Mountains reared up on the far left, impossibly barren and high, and the Avas Gar Range blocked the right flank. The 6 mile trail in between was a major Mujahideen supply line out of the northwest frontier, and it had to be cut. Lila said,
"The British wrote the book over 100 years ago about operations in Afghanistan. Because of their empire, they said, when contemplating an offensive, the very first thing you must plan is your inevitable retreat. And they said, you must save the last bullet for yourself, because you do not want to be taken alive, especially by the women." The company commanders had read that book. The political commissars had been told not to. They had been told that the British had failed only because of their political unsoundness. Soviet ideology was pure, and therefore success was guaranteed. With that delusion, our very own Vietnam began.
The push up the Korengal Valley had been backed by air and artillery power, and had succeeded for the first 3 miles. A fourth had been won yard by yard against opposition that had seemed ferocious to the grunts, but strangely muted to the officers. The officers were right. It was a trap. The Mujahideen waited until Soviet supply lines were stretched 4 miles long, and then they dropped the hammer. Helicopter resupply was largely interdicted by a constant barrage of U.S.-supplied shoulder-launched ground-to-air missiles. Coordinated attacks pinched off the salient at its origin. Late in 1982, thousands of Red Army troops were essentially abandoned in a long, thin chain of inadequate and improvised encampments. The winter weather was awful. Freezing blasts of wind howled constantly along the pass between the mountain ranges, and there were evergreen holly bushes everywhere. Pretty and picturesque in the right context, but not for soldiers forced to work among them. They were gratingly noisy in the wind, and they limited mobility, and they tore skin and shredded uniforms. Then harassment raids had started. Prisoners had been taken in ones and twos. Their fate was appalling. Lila quoted lines that the old British writer Rudyard Kipling had put in a doom-laden poem about failed offensives and groaning, abandoned battlefield casualties and cruel Afghan tribeswomen with knives. When you're wounded on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your God like a soldier. Then she said what had been true even at the zenith of the British Empire's power was still true, and worse. Soviet infantrymen would go missing, and hours later, in the dark, the winter wind would carry the sound of their screaming from unseen enemy camps close by. The screaming would start at a desperate pitch and move slowly and surely upward into insane banshee wailing. Sometimes it would last 10 or 12 hours. Most corpses were never recovered. But sometimes bodies would be returned, missing hands and feet, or whole limbs, or heads, or ears, or eyes, or noses, or penises, or skin.
"Some were flayed alive," Lila said. "Their eyelids would be cut away, and their heads forced down in a frame, so they would have no choice but to watch their skin being peeled back, first from their faces and then from their bodies. The cold anesthetized their wounds to some extent and stopped them dying of shock too soon. Sometimes the process lasted a very long time, or sometimes they would be roasted, alive, on fires. Parcels of cooked meat would show up near our emplacements. At first, the men thought they were gifts of food, perhaps from sympathetic locals, but then they realized. Svetlana Hoff stared on into the room, not seeing anything, looking even bleaker than before. Maybe the tone of her daughter's voice was prompting memories. Certainly, the tone of her daughter's voice was very compelling. Lila had not lived through or witnessed the events she was describing, but it sounded like she had. It sounded like she had witnessed them yesterday. She had moved on from historical detachment. It struck me that she would make a fine storyteller. She had the gift of narrative, she said. They liked to capture our snipers, best of all. They hated our snipers. I think snipers are always hated, perhaps because of the way they kill. My mother was very worried about my father, obviously, and her baby brother. They went out most nights into the low hills with the electronic scope. Not too far. Maybe 1,000 yards to find an angle. Maybe a little more. Far enough to be effective, but close enough to feel safe. But nowhere was really safe. Everywhere was vulnerable. And they had to go. Their orders were to shoot the enemy. Their intention was to shoot the prisoners. They thought it would be a mercy. It was an awful time. And my mother was pregnant by then, with me. I was conceived in a rock trench hacked out of the Carangal floor under a greatcoat that dated back to the end of World War II, and on top of two others that were possibly even older. My mother said they had old bullet holes in them, maybe from Stalingrad. I said nothing. Svetlana stared on. Lila put her hands on the table and tangled her fingers loosely together. She said,